52. When I recorded audio letter 56 last month, I referred to Russia's expanding campaign of weather warfare against the United States. I first revealed that this was beginning last February 1980 in audio letter 54. As I explained then, Russia's weather warfare is in retaliation for America's giant grain embargo against Russia. The embargo and other boycott techniques used lately by the United States against Russia have been imposed by the satanic Bolsheviks who now control America's policies. When I recorded audio letter 54 last February, I gave details of a major Russian breakthrough in weather control. It's a technique by which major storm systems can be created artificially at sea. Then the storms can be guided to specific target areas, and the technique enables rain to be either withheld or released in torrents at will. I gave details about this new Russian weather control technique in the final portion of audio letter 54. That is the portion which had to be released as an emergency transcript because of my heart attack. I was convinced that it was an urgent matter for you to know about this new threat of weather control. And sure enough, during the 6 months since then, Russia has used this new technique to make drastic changes in our weather. But to judge from my mail, some of my listeners do not seem to have read the transcript carefully. That may have been due to their own immediate worry over my serious illness at that time. I don't know. In any case, I believe a few moments of review are in order, because weather warfare is leading toward food shortages as well as other problems. And you cannot protect yourself unless you understand why America's weather is going crazy. I cannot repeat everything I tried to tell you last February, but let me just remind you of some important points. One is that the first test of Russia's new artificial storm technique took place last October 22, 1979, over the South Atlantic. It began with a mammoth double flash, which was spotted by accident by an old American Vela satellite. When word began to leak out about it, the Bolsheviks here in the government launched a disinformation campaign to confuse everyone. They began by announcing the false date of September 22, and for a while they stirred up falsified accounts that it had been a South African or Israeli A-bomb test. Meanwhile, White House and other special study groups were created, supposedly to try to figure it out. Last month in mid-July, the conclusions of the White House group, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the Naval Research Laboratory were made public, and they all disagree. Some say it had to be a nuclear blast, others that it could not have been, and the public remains in the dark. But in the emergency transcript portion of audio letter 54 last February, I told you what the double flash really was. It was created by a twin particle beam blast from Russian weapons on the moon. It was exactly the same double flash phenomenon that I first reported in audio letter 29 for December 1977. The result was what I reported to you last February. To use the same words that I used then, quote, tremendous quantities of seawater in the target zone flashed instantly into superheated steam. The hot water vapor and surrounding hot air started rising fast toward the stratosphere. Cooler air started racing into the target zone to fill the vacuum. The inward rushing winds began to swirl due to the Earth's rotation, and the barometric pressure began dropping in the target zone. Within minutes, the atmosphere above the target zone was a spiraling chimney of tumbling, rising air and water vapor. The world's first totally man-made storm cell was being born over the South Atlantic, unquote. I then continued with details about the methods used by the groups of cosmospheres in order to control the storm cell from that point onward. I described how electron beams are used in order to keep the water vapor airborne instead of forming into rain. This basic technique has been used in order to interfere with natural cloud production this summer in the United States. The result has been an extended drought and killer heat wave over much of our country. And now, the food shortages, which I tried to warn you about 6 months ago, are beginning to cast their shadow. America's spring wheat and corn crops have suffered major reductions, and other crops have suffered too. The effects are already beginning to show up in higher prices at your supermarket. And now, the specter of water shortage is growing worse by the day in some areas. But the most dramatic Russian weather war attack so far began just a few days after I recorded audio letter 56 last month. And it made use of the very techniques I detailed last February, scaled up and intensified. When I recorded audio letter 56 on July 30, I referred to Russia's expanding weather warfare. And I gave a warning that, quote, "Next, my friends, we must brace ourselves for hurricanes unlike anything ever seen before in America," unquote. As I said those words, Russian weather control weapons were at work in the Atlantic Ocean, east of the Caribbean. Taking advantage of favorable conditions, they were setting off Tropical Storm Allen, the first of the season. 4 days later, August the 3rd, it began creeping into the news. It had just grown into Hurricane Allen and was growing fast. That night, it pounded across the island of Barbados with 125-mile winds. Then it changed course, just in time for the center to miss St. Lucia. Even so, 8 people lay dead as it pounded off into the Caribbean. By August 5th, Hurricane Allen was making headlines as the hurricane of the century, quote-unquote. As it made its way across the open waters of the Caribbean, it was already packing 160-mile winds and still growing. By the next day, it was rated a Category 5 hurricane, the worst there is. Peak winds were 170 miles per hour, and Puerto Rico, 250 miles away, was receiving gusts up to 70 miles per hour. Hurricane Allen was a killer hurricane, rated the most dangerous ever to strike the eastern Caribbean. But for the first several days, most forecasters in the United States were confident that there was no threat to our own coastline. It looked like it was heading for southern Mexico or Central America. But in fact, Russian cosmospheres were steering the storm. They were shooting for the narrow gap between Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula and Cuba's west coast. Up to that point, the hurricane's path through the Caribbean was chosen for the least contact possible with land for 2 reasons. For one thing, the Russians wanted to minimize the number of unintended victims and damage. But even more, they wanted to conserve maximum force in the hurricane for the ultimate target, our own Gulf Coast. This is why Hurricane Allen kept mystifying weather forecasters with its unexpected twists and turns. The only place in the Caribbean where Hurricane Allen swerved toward major land masses was in the vicinity of southeastern Cuba. The hurricane's eye had been heading straight for Jamaica, but at the last minute, it turned and went between Jamaica and southwest Haiti. It pounded our naval base at Guantanamo Bay in southeast Cuba, and then moved further out to sea again. It bruised the tip of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, but avoided populated areas. Then it entered the Gulf of Mexico. Building up again, the hurricane of the century headed for the South Texas coast. The killer storm, with nearly 100 dead in its wake, headed straight for Brownsville. But the Russians were not interested in Brownsville, and they halted the storm while the center was still more than 90 miles offshore. Once again, America's weather forecasters watched with mouths agape as another prediction fell apart. Hurricane Allen ignored Brownsville and started northward. Up to this point, the Russian attack plan using Hurricane Allen was right on track. But from this point onward, it started falling apart. The Russians were hoping to strike three targets along the Gulf Coast with the same hurricane. The intended targets were the Houston-Galveston area, then New Orleans, and finally Mobile, Alabama. This was to be done by keeping the eye of the hurricane at sea. The Cosmospheres were to guide the hurricane along the coast of the Houston area, then inward towards land to do as much damage as possible. Then they were instructed to pull the hurricane back out to sea to rebuild it before it could collapse over land. With its power rebuilt, the plan was to move on to New Orleans, repeat the process, and so on. But Hurricane Allen was by far the largest storm system which the Russian weather warriors have attempted to control. And when they turned the storm northward at Brownsville, they started miscalculating. They were trying to make Hurricane Allen go against very powerful natural forces. And they tried to do it too fast. Cosmospheres over the Gulf of Mexico generated proton clouds in the atmosphere at three points. These points were south of Houston and south and east of the Louisiana coast. As I described in Audio Letter 54, proton clouds are used to steer a storm system. But this time, the Russians made a bad miscalculation in spacing their proton clouds. The storm did start northward toward Houston as planned, and on the way did some damage to Corpus Christi, Texas. But the greatest effect of the proton clouds was not as planned. They badly disrupted the circulation of winds around the hurricane. As a result, the whole storm rapidly fell apart. Thanks to the Russian miscalculation, the killer hurricane of the century, Hurricane Allen, ended in anticlimax. But, my friends, the Russian weather warriors have learned from this mistake, just as they have learned from past mistakes. Artificial storms, rainstorms, hurricanes, or blizzards are now a powerful weapon in Russia's arsenal. And the kamikaze war plans of our own Bolshevik rulers are causing these weather weapons to be used against you and me. Topic number 3. Last month I reported to you that more and more people are asking me, what can I do? I responded by giving you step 1 of my answer. As I told you then, it is only the very first step. Many more will have to follow if there is to be any hope for our country. The old adage is still true, that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. And, my friends, we have a very long way to go. I said last month that I would have more to say about what we can do, on one condition. That condition depended on you. I said that I would tell you more if and only if I received evidence that many of you are taking action. And I'm glad to report that up to now, many of you are responding wholeheartedly in this campaign to try to save our land. For that reason, I'm about to tell you what we can and we must do next. Because, I emphasize again, we will accomplish absolutely nothing unless we stick with it. We have to embark on a campaign in which we refuse to be defeated. And it has to be a campaign that grows bigger and stronger, day by day, week by week. Numbers count. Every single one of you counts. You count. And so do your neighbors and friends. The stakes are nothing less than freedom and survival itself. I cannot in good conscience raise any false hopes about what we are doing. We have already waited far too long for there to be any guarantee of success. But if we do not act, we will guarantee failure. Knowing that there is action which you can take, you cannot avoid making a decision about what to do about it. If you just put it off or can't make up your mind, that is a decision not to act. And if you decide not to act, then you are casting your vote against America. If you do not act, you are voting for economic disaster, for satanic Bolshevik dictatorship, and for America's destruction in nuclear war one, because those are the things which are almost upon us unless we, the people, do our constitutional duty to stop it. But if you are joining those who are taking action, then you are casting your vote for America by demanding the truth about our nation's gold reserves. You are voting for economic survival, for freedom, and for prevention of nuclear war. I believe that the time has come for all of us to do what is right simply because it is right. Last month, I explained that our campaign to save America must begin with our economy. Specifically, we must begin by bringing about a truthful accounting of what has happened to our country's monetary gold reserves. Because the most basic of all our economic woes is our collapsing dollar. And it is collapsing because, contrary to official Treasury statements, our gold is gone. Only a few small dregs of highly impure gold are left. It's like the so-called gold medallions which went on sale by the United States government on July 15. These medallions are much lower in gold content than the advertising leads one to believe. And to make matters even worse, many of the medallions were botched during the alloying process. As a result, there is less gold near the rim than there is in the center of the medallion. Even the natives in the bush in Africa know that if the money is corrupt, the government is corrupt. If we want to survive economically, politically, and militarily, we must clean out the corruption in our land. And the starting point to do that is to get back our gold reserves and so return to an honest dollar. Last month in step one about what you can do, I urge each one of you to write to Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin. I suggested that you urge him to open up a full public investigation of the Fort Knox gold scandal. As a starting point, I refer to the giant secret shipment of gold which left Fort Knox on January 20, 1965, the very day Lyndon Johnson was inaugurated president. Many of you have sent me copies of the letters you have sent to Senator Proxmire since hearing my tape last month. So I'm now going to outline my suggestions for step two in what you can do. We must continue to concentrate on Senator Proxmire, but we need to do other things too. If you have not yet taken step one, which I outlined last month, please do it now. Join with the rest of us in this campaign. We cannot stand still, my friends. Either we go forward or we fall backward and fail. Step two in what you can do can be divided into three parts. Each one is something which is well within your power to do, and each one is important. First, I want to give you access to more information which you can use as your ammunition in this battle. Second, I want to suggest that you use this information in follow-up correspondence with Senator Proxmire. And third, I want to point out how you can use the same information to start spreading the word to other people you know. Let me begin with a matter of additional information about our gold reserves. This is printed material which you can use both to educate yourself and to alert your friends. First, my friend Mr. Edward Durrell has published two pamphlets which I would recommend as a starting point. One is titled 52 Unanswered Questions Regarding Alleged Gold Reserves of the United States. The other is the transcript of a speech by Mr. Durrell titled How the United States Lost Its Gold Reserves. Both pamphlets give many facts, figures, names, and dates. Mr. Durrell has agreed to make available a supply of these two pamphlets for distribution without charge from my national headquarters here in Washington. Anyone in the United States may obtain these two pamphlets by sending a large self-addressed envelope bearing proper postage to my office. Be sure to send a business-size, number 10 envelope, not something smaller, and apply 28 cents postage. It will also speed things up if you will mark your envelope with the word pamphlets in the lower left corner. Send it to me, Dr. Beter, Suite 5092, 1629 K Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20006. My listeners outside the United States may receive the pair of pamphlets by sending your name and address plus $2 to cover airmail postage and handling. There is also another place where you may now obtain additional information, and that is from a congressman, Dr. Ron Paul of Texas. On July 30, 1980, the day I recorded audio letter 56, Congressman Paul rose to speak in Congress. His purpose was to introduce a bill designated H.R. 7874, the Monetary Freedom Act. The bill contains eight separate titles, but the first is the most important of all. Here is how Congressman Paul explained it before the House of Representatives, and I now quote, Title I requires the Secretary of the Treasury to perform a full assay, inventory, and audit of the gold reserves of the United States. This thorough study is to be completed within 6 months of the passage of the bill and double-checked by the General Accounting Office. The results of the study are to be sent to Congress so that the representatives of the people will learn, for the first time in almost 30 years, the true status of our gold reserves. The Congress will, in turn, release the information to the American people. Although present law requires an annual inventory of our gold reserves, the law is not being complied with, and only a small portion of the reserves are audited each year. As any businessman knows, that is no way to conduct an inventory, and this bill would correct that deficiency. Such a complete audit, inventory, and assay would lay to rest the persistent rumors that gold is missing from our national stockpile, and that the gold we have is of inferior quality. End of quotation from Congressman Paul's remarks. My friends, by introducing the Monetary Freedom Act, Congressman Dr. Ron Paul has displayed courage that is rare indeed in Congress today. I strongly suggest that you write to Congressman Paul and request a copy of his bill, H.R. 7874. And while you are at it, be sure to express your appreciation and support for his efforts. The address is Representative Ron Paul, P-A-U-L, House Office Building, Washington, D.C. It will cost you only a few minutes' time and a few cents in postage to obtain your copies of the Monetary Freedom Act and Mr. Durrell's pamphlets. And for that small price, you will be rewarded with information that is powerful ammunition for you to use. The next question is, how do you use it? The answer is that knowledge like this will be useful to you again and again. But for now, I suggest that you make use of these materials in two ways. One is for follow-up in your correspondence with Senator Proxmire. The other is in spreading the word among your friends and neighbors. In your follow-up with Senator Proxmire, it's time to write him again now, whether or not he answered you last month. If he has answered you, by all means express your appreciation and take account of whatever he said. But as I warned you last month, beware of attempts to just brush you off, which are standard practice here in Washington today. Up to now, not one of the many people who have reported writing to Proxmire has reported receiving a reply from him. If that is the case with you, let him know that ignoring you will not make you go away. In any case, I suggest that you call Senator Proxmire's attention to the bill just introduced in the House of Representatives by Congressman Paul. You might ask him why it takes a junior congressman to ask for the truth about our gold reserves instead of Proxmire, the champion of the Golden Fleece Award. urge him to contact his counterpart in the House, Congressman Henry Royce, R-E-U-S-S, Chairman of the House Banking Committee. Both Proxmire and Royce are from Wisconsin, so why should they not talk to one another? Urge Senator Proxmire to take the lead in a joint congressional investigation. Once you have written your follow-up letter to Senator Proxmire, I urge you to start sharing all this with your friends and neighbors. They're not likely to hear one word about it in the news, so I suggest that you begin by showing them Congressman Paul's Monetary Freedom Act. Call their attention to what he said about the gold inventory law not being complied with for nearly 30 years regarding our gold reserves. Once they realize that this is a matter which has been put before Congress, they are likely to be more receptive to learning more about our plight. Of course, you will find that many people will just close their eyes. But for those who are interested, show them what is at stake in the gold scandal, that is, our economic survival. And if you can, ask them to write to Senator Proxmire, too. They don't have to be convinced that our gold is gone. All that matters is that they agree that we, the people, have a right to know, to learn the truth. My friends, I have suggested guidelines for three things you can do as parts of Step 2 in what you can do. First, arm yourself with more information. Second, follow up with Senator Proxmire. Third, start spreading the word to others. It may sound like a lot listening to it all at once, but just take it at one step at a time, at your own pace. Just do one thing at a time, but keep at it. That's what matters. Ultimately, our goal is very simple. Either gold is there or it is not there. And so the Fort Knox Bullion Depository will have to be opened up once again. It must be an honest inspection, unlike the carefully staged peep show of September 1974. It must include the crucial Central Core Vault, whose existence was never mentioned to the September 1974 visitors. That presents a problem, my friends, because the Central Core Vault is contaminated with plutonium-239, as I revealed in Audio Letter 5. But somehow, it must be done, because if it is not done, we will continue down the path to thermonuclear war. It is now time to give you my last-minute summary. Suffice it to say that we are drawing closer and closer to nuclear war one. All-out war between the United States and Russia will be set off by the United States by means of a first strike. The closer we come to war itself, the closer these things are coming to the surface in the news. Only this month, this was reflected in two major policy announcements by the United States. One is America's unprecedented shift to a counterforce nuclear strategy against Russia, a first-strike nuclear posture. And along with that policy is its twin brother, calling for better protection of certain governmental leaders in case of war. Our Bolshevik rulers are preparing to protect themselves while they sacrifice us on the altar of satanic power. I've tried to urge you to see for yourselves where we are heading, to stop and think of the true consequences of following our leaders into war, and to offer you some alternatives, some things that you can do yourself in an effort to turn the tide before disaster strikes. There's no guarantee of success if we do act, my friends. But if we do not act, there is a guarantee that our country will die soon in nuclear war one. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.